Imagine being just 18 years old and facing the death penalty. The youngest woman to be sentenced to death in the state of Tennessee. This is exactly what we're going to be talking about in tonight's episode. Uncovering the story of Krista Pike, the youngest woman sentenced to death in Tennessee.
You are now tuned in to Talks at Midnight, a podcast that dives into haunted histories and chilling murder mysteries. I'm your host, Janet Heredia, and thank you for joining me on today's episode.
This is a story that touches on psychological trauma, manipulation, and one of the most shocking crimes to ever take place on the grounds of Job Corps. From her turbulent upbringing to the details of the brutal murder she committed, this case is filled with disturbing layers. Let's begin by taking a close look at Krista Pike's early life, which may offer some insight into the factors that shaped her. Krista had a really tough childhood. It's safe to say that she probably didn't have a very good chance of excelling in life from the very beginning. Going back to before she was even born and she was in the womb, her mother, who surprisingly being a registered nurse, was also a drug addict and an alcoholic. And when she was pregnant with Krista, she actually drank so much that she caused permanent brain damage and delay to Krista, causing her to be born with frontal lobe damage. Now, if you're familiar with the frontal lobe, it is the part of your brain that is responsible for decision making, and it is responsible for being able to distinguish the difference between right and wrong. From what the reports say and documentaries that have actually, you know, interviewed her mother and know the backstory that you really don't find much of online. It took me a really long time to be able to get this detail about her life because they kind of summarize it for you in a sense where they don't tell you the details leading up to the murders. And those details are very important to understand how she got to where she got. And so this is very important for you guys to hear. Now, just so that you know, when Krista Pike was born with that frontal lobe damaged, she developed epilepsy and seizures. And her mother, who was too busy partying, would drop her off in family members' homes. Anybody who would literally take care of Krista, she would just drop her off there and disappear. It is said that because of that, Krista was physically abused by at least 7 family members and friends, and her mother never did anything about it, nor did she even believe her if and when she ever voiced a concern to her mother. It was so bad when Krista was little, toddler years at that, that one of the people that were watching her was reporting that Krista actually had a seizure with her, to which she then proceeded to try to reach her mother, Carissa, and there was no way of reaching her. So she ended up taking Krista to the hospital because she really had no other choice. She had no idea what to do. So she takes Krista to the hospital, and then the hospital tried to reach Carissa. Nobody could get a hold of her. And then finally, the person that was caring for Krista got a hold of Carissa, to which Carissa tells her, "Well, you seem to have everything under control. I will see you later. Call me when you get back." And so, being a mother myself, I can't even imagine somebody calling me, telling me that they're in the hospital with my child. I would drop whatever I'm doing and make sure that I rush to the hospital. I don't care if the hospital is an airplane right away. I will be booking the next flight because I'm a mother and I care about my child and I want to be there through it all, whether it's a good moment, a bad moment. That is what a mother does. That is what a father does. When you love someone and you have this connection with this person and something bad happens to them or something good, you genuinely want to be there to support. I couldn't imagine not being there for my kid. through the worst, through the best times, whatever. And so starting your life in that way is very sad. And so, you know, Krista got used to that life. Krista got used to the neglect. I don't think she ever knew what it was like for her mother to care for her. From what the stories tell, the aunt, I'm not sure from what side of the family, but the aunt said that oftentimes when Krista was a toddler, she would be on the floor in her home where she lived with her mother, Carissa, and they had a dog. And every time the dog would, you know, defecate on the floor, her mother wouldn't clean it up. And so Krista, as a toddler, oftentimes would be rolling around on the floor, crawling around dog shit. There are images in some documentaries online where they actually post images of the inside of Carissa's home. And let me just say, it is disgusting. I have no idea how anyone could even live like that with or without children. It is disgusting. And so this is the type of life that Krista was, you know, subjected to. And remember, this is when she was a baby. Who was to say that anything was going to happen later on down the line in her life? So it is very tragic, and it is a very sad story from the very beginning, you know. And just think about it in the sense of, like, if you're a parent, a mother specifically, and you find out that you're pregnant, you would assume that if you're a drinker, you will stop. If you smoke pot, you're going to stop. Anything that can possibly cause any type of harm to your fetus, you're not going to do. And so this is called mother love and mother instinct. I guess Carissa, she didn't have that. And that was so sad for Krista that she had to live like that. Oftentimes, she would be passed along, and she lived in different families' homes. And this is when she experienced the multiple amounts of abuse, of verbal abuse, of physical abuse. She would get punched and hit and all of the things. And so going back to her mother's house was always her end result. The problem is that Krista's mom was in and out of relationships, and every single relationship that this woman would involve herself with would ultimately cause harm to Krista. It was almost like the girl had nowhere to go. She had nowhere to run to. Just when you thought that things might possibly get a little bit better, they just seemed to get worse. Because then she had to go live with her grandmother, who was another witch. She was terrible. She treated her like shit. She pushed and shoved her, called her names, would kick her out of the house. Her boyfriend or her husband would also be very abusive and very mean towards Krista. So it was almost like no matter where Krista went, she had nowhere to go, actually. It was a dead end. And so this is something so sad that any child would have to endure. And mind you, this is all before she turned 13 years old. So not long after that, Krista attempted suicide by overdosing on Tylenol. That's when she was diagnosed with depression, but she was never treated for it, nor did her mother ever take her to any follow-up appointments. And this is all coming from doctors that had previously seen her and diagnosed her. She would just go silent. She got diagnosed with it, and off they went. Her mom never, ever cared to treat her daughter. And so when the suicide attempt happened, Krista went to live with her paternal grandmother. Now, this is her biological father's mother. And it was there that she finally felt like she was being cared for. This lady loved her, gave her a stable home, provided for her, and was more like a friend to her. So Krista finally felt like she was somewhere where she can thrive, where she can excel in life. She finally felt like she had an opportunity at a good life. And so not long after that, sadly, her grandmother was diagnosed with cancer and ended up passing away. So now here is Krista, finally somewhere where she felt loved. And now, after all of the trauma, She has to watch this person who she loves whittle away into nothing and pass away. Now, what do you think happened after that? Krista had to move back with her mother. Now Krista's 13 years old, and now she's living with her mother. Well, guess what happened? Krista was sexually assaulted by her mother's now fifth boyfriend. Following this assault, Krista was removed from her home by Child Protective Services, but returned home after only 3 months with minimal follow-up. At age 17, Krista was raped again by a stranger who lived right down the block. Now, hospital confirms the rape. Literally, the hospital did that rape kit thing, told the mother about it, and she still didn't believe it. She didn't believe Krista. How sick of an individual are you to not believe your child after A, going to the hospital and the hospital confirming that she was raped? I mean, I don't understand. I don't understand how anybody could be so heartless. Now, Krista Pike did not just get raped once by a neighbor. She was walking down the street and some random guy threw her in the bushes and raped her repeatedly. And while he was raping her, he was hitting her on the head. Like, just terrible. And the only reason that he actually stopped was because there was a car that passed by and interrupted him. And here is Krista. Her head is getting bashed by the concrete or a rock, not exactly sure, and getting raped multiple times. After having lived the life that she had lived at this point, I think the girl gave up with life. Suicide attempts, abuse, epilepsy, seizures due to brain trauma from her mother drinking and not giving a shit about her when she was pregnant. It's almost like every single turn, or it is like every single turn, it got worse and worse. By the time Krista was a teenager, she had already exhibited signs of emotional and behavior problems. She would often clash with authority figures, struggled in school, and she became known for defiance. Desperate for attention and lacking any form of guidance, Krista began experimenting with drugs, including marijuana and LSD. And of course, this affected her grades. And so by the time she was 18, Krista had dropped out of high school entirely. What can we expect? Someone that has gone through a multitude of tragic scenarios and being put in situations out of their control, being violated, raped, abused, beat up, being called names. It gets to the point where the person will start believing that they're not worthy. Nobody cares about her. Nobody tried to make life better for her. I'm pretty sure she felt like nothing. And so it was around this time that she began showing symptoms of severe mental health issues, and multiple reports indicate that Krista was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder and bipolar disorder, with reason. Now, these disorders, which cause mood swings, emotional instability, and difficulty with interpersonal relationships, were never properly treated in her case. Additionally, Krista's mother once told the court that her daughter had experienced several head injuries as a child, though there has been no formal diagnosis of traumatic brain injury linked to that behavior. Now, the combination of neglect, instability, and untreated mental illness created a dangerous cocktail. So in 1994, Krista decided to change her life. So she enrolled in a program funded by the government in Knoxville, Tennessee, called Job Corps. Now, I'm a millennial. I am 40 years old, And I can tell you right now, I remember this program. If I'm not mistaken, there was a Job Corps program here in Florida. I'm from South Florida. And at the time, if I'm not mistaken, there was a Job Corps down south, like in Homestead. And so they had these programs around different states and different areas. And these are government funded programs. So what happens in these programs is adolescents with difficulty learning in school, students that are troubled, perhaps have been had some run-ins with the law, they would go to this school. It was even a school where if you got caught for anything and you went to court, rather than send you to jail or juvie, the judge would assign you to go to Job Corps. And now this place is a place that you go to earn a certificate, a trade of some sorts. It was like an opportunity school where you would go and essentially you live in campus or on campus. And by the time you leave, you will have learned a trade of sorts and thus then get a job and be able to rehabilitate. And so that is exactly what she did. Now, the program was supposed to offer her a fresh start, but instead it became the setting for one of Tennessee's most brutal murders. It was at Job Corps that Krista Pike met 17-year-old Tadaryl Shipp through her friend, which she made when she was there. Her name was Kim Eolio. Now, interviews with Kim say, well, Kim was saying that she introduced her to Tadaryl, and from the moment that she introduced her to Tadaryl, they were like unstoppable together. They were always together, inseparable, I mean. And they were just, you know, they hit it off immediately. Now, quick backstory on Tadaryl. Tadaryl was a very, very troubled kid. He was about a year younger than Krista, a year or two. I think he was like 17 years old. And this kid was into satanic rituals and stuff. And he had been involved in that since he was 11 years old. And so this kid was not any better. I mean, I don't think that he was such a good influence to have around Krista. But then again, I don't know if Kim Eolio knew this about Tadaryl, because from my understanding, these relationships were formed in Job Corps. So they didn't know each other past that. So I'm pretty sure that this side of Tadaryl was a side that wasn't very, very known. But then there are stories of people that used to attend the Job Corps that said that the kid was strange, and that some people even had, you know, they had speculated that the kid was into devil worship. So that is something to note, because it does have something to do later on in the story. Now, the two quickly formed a bond based on their shared sense of alienation and rebellion, and Krista and Tadaryl became inseparable, entering into an intense romantic relationship. Their connection went far beyond the usual teenage romance, because Krista and Tadaryl became obsessed with the occult, particularly Satanism. Together, they dived into dark rituals and shared fantasies of power and control through supernatural means. Now, while their relationship spiraled deeper into darker territory, Krista's obsession with Tadaryl only intensified. She grew possessive and paranoid, particularly around other women in the Job Corps program. One woman in particular became her target, because from what Krista knows, or from what Krista later learned, before she met Tadaryl, before she got to Job Corps, Tadaryl had a crush on this girl named Colleen Slemmer, who was 19 years old at the time. Now, Colleen Slemmer had joined the Job Corps in Knoxville, just like Krista, to get her life back on track. There was no real history of animosity between Krista and Colleen, but Krista fixated on the idea that Colleen was flirting with Tadaryl based on the fact that she knew Tadaryl had a crush on her previously. However, they never dated, nor did Colleen ever mention to anybody that she had any interest in this kid. So there was actually no substantial evidence to support this, but in Krista's mind, Colleen became a rival. Krista began telling friends and fellow Job Corps students that Colleen needed to be taught a lesson. This baseless jealousy and fixation on Tadaryl's loyalty drove Krista to plan something unimaginable. She convinced Tadero to help her and their friend Shadola Peterson, another Job Corps student who would have been present for what would soon become a terrifying night. Now, this is something I'm reading off of the notes that I have here, but from the story that I saw in the documentary, she did mention this to Tadero. She did kind of convince him to help her, but then Tadero also told her that he was actually looking for a sacrifice to fulfill a satanic ritual that he had been planning, and that perhaps Colleen would be the perfect fit for that. So in January 12th of 1995, Krista Tadero and Shadola decided they were going to lure Colleen to a secluded area in the woods on the University of Tennessee's campus by telling her that they wanted to call a truce, they wanted to squash any problems that they had, and that they had some weed and they wanted to go smoke with her and just call it a truce. So obviously, as it turned out, Colleen believed them. And so unfortunately, they all four checked out of Job Corps because, by the way, when you lived on campus, there were certain times that you were able to clock out and be able to leave campus because, you know, it wasn't a place where you had to be at 24 hours a day. It wasn't like a rehab or anything. So you were free to go if you needed to go. You just had to check in and out. And so all four of them checked out. Now, putting my notes down, I do want to add, because this is something that I got from the documentary, and you cannot find this anywhere online, but they did interview Kim Eolio, who was, like I said earlier, the girl that made fast friends with Krista, who said nothing but great things about Krista. She said there was no red flags when she met her. As a matter of fact, when Kim Eolio got sick, Krista would go to or went to the store, got a bunch of candy and snacks, brought it to her, made sure that she was comfortable and that she felt better, and was always very loving and caring towards her, to the point of saying, "I love you," and all of these things. And so Kim Eolio didn't feel any bad energy when it came to Krista, because she was always just so kind to her. And so Kim Eolio did mention that there was several times that she heard Krista say these really nasty things about Colleen, like she needs to go. It got to the point where even once she said she wanted to kill her. But Kim says that she didn't take it very seriously because she's like, you know how teenagers are when they have problems with each other. They talk a lot of shit. And, you know, I'm sure we all have had a situation, a mean girl situation, where we maybe not like somebody and we're, you know, talking in confidence with our best friend, talking about, you know, F this bitch or whatever. I know I've had those moments. And, you know, you don't think anything of it. You don't think that the person that's saying that is going to actually go and do something harmful towards the person that they don't like, especially something that was never really like proven to her. You know what I mean? Normally, a normal person would say, "Hey, let's talk about it. I think you're trying to screw my man, and what's up? Like, tell me what's going on." You know what I mean? That is something a normal person would do. But we're talking about Krista Pike here, who's had nothing but trauma, frontal lobe damaged, you know? So anyway, Kim also said that on this January 12th day, she said Krista came into the room and told her that she needed to get rid of Colleen. And Kim said that she brushed it off. She didn't take it seriously. And then Krista left her dorm. Colleen said that shortly after, she noticed Krista, Tadero, Shadola, and Colleen leaving the campus together. And that she was like, okay, that is weird. But that she didn't do anything or say anything about it because she didn't think that it was going to, that she was actually going to do anything. But thinking back now, if I were Kim, I probably, well, maybe Kim felt like maybe she really was not going to do anything to her, especially that there were other people there with her. Or maybe she really did feel some something that day, and maybe she felt like if she said something, she was gonna feel Krista's wrath or something, or maybe get on her bad side, or I don't know. I don't know what went on in Kimmy Olio's mind that day, but that is certainly a red flag if I ever saw one. So back to these four individuals. Once in the woods, the group ambushed Colleen, and over the course of 30 to 45 minutes, Krista and Tadero brutally assaulted her. They kicked her, they punched her, they slashed her with a box cutter and a small meat cleaver like a weapon. According to the records, Krista taunted Colleen during the entire attack. Supposedly, Colleen kept trying to get up, gushing of blood with stab wounds, beat up marks, like everything all over, and would try to get up and sit up and like stand up to run away. But every time that she would try, Krista would continue to beat her and just like abuse her and torture her. Krista had a box cutter and a meat cleaver. Do you know what a meat cleaver is? It's those meat tenderizers. They're like a stainless steel color and they have like these little like teeth on it. And this is what she was beating Colleen up with. It got so bad that apparently she slit Colleen's throat, but because she was using a box cutter, she didn't penetrate it enough, so Colleen didn't die. The poor girl was alive for 30 to 45 minutes while all of this was taking place. And you know what? While all of this was happening, she was accusing her of seducing Tadero. And Colleen kept telling her, gargling blood, "Why are you doing this to me?" It was so sad that even Colleen at one point, she tells her, "Let me go, please. I will not even get my things and I will run home and nobody will ever see me again." She begged and begged for her life, but Krista showed no mercy. Now, in a twisted display of cruelty, Krista and Shadola at this point grabbed this poor girl by her legs and her arms and held her back, okay? While Tadero carved a pentagram onto Colleen's chest. And this is when Colleen was still alive. Then, when Krista Pike saw that she was still alive, barely hanging on, she hit her one good last time with the asphalt, and that was when Colleen passed away. Now, you would think that we're done. That's it. The crime is done. Let's go. But no. Krista decides that she needs a souvenir. So she reaches down and she takes a piece of Colleen's skull and puts it in her pocket. And this is when the job was done. They left her in the leaves in the middle of the woods and they took off back to school, clocked in like nothing happened, completely covered in blood, and they each went to their dorms. Now, according to Kim Iolio, who, if you remember, is her best friend at Job Corps, Krista went straight to her dorm. When Kim saw Krista, Krista tells her, "By the way, this is not mud. This is the bitch's blood. I cut her throat 6 times, and the bitch would not die." Could you imagine being Kim Iolio in that very room at that very time with someone who you thought was your best friend and they come and they tell you what they just did? What could possibly have been going through Kim Iolio's head at that time? Krista then tells her that she has a souvenir to where she pulls out a piece of her skull and showed it to Kim Iolio. Once she did that, she started leaving the room. She turns around and looks at Kim and tells her, "You better not tell anybody or I'll kill you too." And according to Kim Iolio, Krista gave her a wink, a smile, said she loved her, and walked out of the dorm. After Krista left Kim Iolio's dorm, she began to show off the piece of skull around the school. They noticed that Colleen was missing because the logbook showed that Pike, Ship, Peterson, and Slemmer had left together and only three returned. Detectives found the piece of skull in Pike's jacket pocket because obviously when the officials at the school saw that Colleen was missing, they had punched out together, all four of them, and only three came back. And I'm pretty sure that because Krista was boasting and showing this skull around, somebody felt uneasy and maybe told them, which made them go check on the log at the school, them being the school officials. And then they probably were the ones that ultimately called authorities, to which then they sent detectives over there. And when detectives went into Krista's space or whatever, they found the piece of skull in her pocket. Now, obviously, they arrested her. And believe it or not, Pike confessed to the police of the torture and the killings of Colleen. But she insisted that they were merely trying to scare her and that it got out of control. Colleen, Shadola, and Tadaro are now in jail and Pike's awaiting trial. Now, during her trial, the prosecution was aided by evidence and Pike's confession. Pike was charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder on March 22nd of 1996. But after only a few hours of deliberation, Pike was found guilty on both counts. On March 30th, Pike was sentenced to death by electrocution for the murder charge and 25 years in prison for the conspiracy charge. Tadaro received a life sentence with the possibility of parole plus 25 years, and this is because he was under 18 when this happened, so the death penalty doesn't apply, therefore he escaped that death penalty. But because Krista was 19, she was already of age, therefore she got the death penalty. Shadola, from what the case files reveal, ended up talking to authorities and cooperating, and that girl only got 6 years of probation and she was let out. So basically she turned informant and then received a plea of probation, or received probation after a plea of guilty, and then, you know, she also got accessory after the fact. So that girl got away with it. And then the only one that got the death penalty was Krista Pike. So now Krista Pike is in prison. She's on death row. And you would think that that's it. Lock her up, throw away the key, forget about her. But no, because Krista, she at this point, she has nothing to lose. At this point, who cares, right? She's never going to get out of prison. So it doesn't matter what she does. She's on death row. You cannot possibly get a worse sentence. So what's to lose, right? Well, guess what she did? Got together with another inmate who was there for something similar, murder, pretty much. I think her name was Natasha Cornett. And they managed to plot up an escape plan with the help of a corrections officer and a guy who she had become a pen pal friend with. And the guy was so infatuated with her that he would fly 3,000 miles from New Jersey to go visit her in prison every so often. And this guy was the one that tried to get her to escape, or tried to help her escape. The guy ended up going to jail. I don't even know how he got caught or how they got caught. I believe it was because of the corrections officer that was also helping her. And I think the guy only got like disciplinary action and maybe lost his job. But I don't think the corrections officer went to jail. I know for a fact that the other guy did go to jail. I don't know for how long. To be honest with you, I didn't even care to look, but this happened. So, I mean, when you think about it, you're on death row. You've committed the worst possible crime. You've got the worst possible sentence. What do you have to lose at this point, right? So I think that's probably where her mindset was at. So I don't know. That's only her, for her to know, pretty much. What I can say is that the last update that I did get, it was 2022, and Krista is still alive. I'm not sure about this year. I could double check, but Krista Pike was alive in 2022. She did have a sentencing date, like an execution date, but because of COVID, it all got postponed, and so she kind of dodged that bullet right there. But throughout the years, she filed appeals and clemency petitions, and they were all denied over and over again. And however, she has managed to keep her story in the media over the years, I guess because she wants the community to come together. According to Krista, she doesn't want to come out of prison because she knows that that's never going to happen. She's trying to avoid the death penalty, being that she's gone through such a hard time in her life and that she does have mental health issues and she has a frontal lobe damage, as we've mentioned multiple times throughout the story. There's proof. I believe they did an MRI and you can clearly see in the MRI the damage to her frontal lobe. So the fact that Tadero gets away with it and he was just as part of this gruesome murder as she was, and they didn't give him the death penalty, I think that maybe they could have gone without giving her the death penalty as well and just had her like rot in prison for the rest of her life. But that's just my opinion. So fast forward to August 30th of 2023, Pike's lawyers used the Supreme Court ruling State versus Booker in an attempt to reopen her bid to have her 1996 conviction and sentence thrown out. Pike's lawyers argued her young age and damaged mental health at the time of the killing should spare her from facing execution. But in October of 2023, the Knox County Criminal Court Judge Scott Green denied her request, saying that the November 2022 Supreme Court ruling did not apply to her. The Booker case addressed only juvenile offenders in Tennessee. Thus, Krista was 18 and not a juvenile at the time of the offense. Pike was a legal adult. Remember, she was 19 years old. So fast forward March 10th of 2024 now, the state has not yet set an execution date. If Pike is executed, she will be the first woman to be executed in the state of Tennessee in about 200 years. Krista Pike knows that her numbers, that her days are extremely numbered now. She might get an execution date any day now, because the girl has already spent a life sentence in prison on death row. So she's about almost done with that other sentencing that she, remember, she got the death sentence and then she got the 25-year sentence and she's about up there. So, you know, we're getting close, guys. As soon as I find out anything, I will definitely update you guys. But nonetheless, Krista Pike's life, it's a haunting reminder of how unchecked trauma, mental illness, and a lack of guidance can lead to devastating consequences. Her crime was one of the most brutal in Tennessee's history, and the sheer senselessness of it continues to disturb those who hear her story. Now, I have been reading this story for the past 2 weeks, and I can tell you right now that I can read this story over and over again, and I will be disturbed each and every time. At just 18, she became the youngest woman on death row, and this is a title that she still holds decades later. Whether Krista's story is one of pure evil or a tragic outcome of a life filled with neglect and instability is something people will continue to debate. But one thing is for certain. The night of January 12, 1995, left a permanent scar on the Knoxville community and on everyone involved. Thank you so much for joining me on this dark journey tonight. If you want to hear more true crime stories, paranormal stories, and unsolved mysteries, please make sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast and leave us a review. It helps us. Until next time, guys, remember, The past is never truly behind us. It echoes in the stories that we tell and the lessons that we learn. Until next time.